From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us in studio is Brian Moran. He is Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Brian Moran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Coach.
Tom,
great
I
to be back
overheard here. That Brian was actually broadcasting from our green room outside, saying that he wanted to discuss hurricane preparation in Virginia. Let's make sure we don't ask about that.
I think we know all we need to know about hurricane. Given the fact we haven't had any hurricanes.
If we, hey, please,
I was there with
Tom.
Hurricane Gloria. Let's jinx it so we can have one to cover.
Oh my goodness!
No, we won't. We won't try to jinx it. First, let's talk about the District of Columbia. Last week on this broadcast, you mentioned that at-large D.C. Council member Vincent Orange, who was defeated in the June primary and who has taken a job as the head of the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, a job which he intended to occupy while staying on the council. Last week, you mentioned that even as we were speaking, it was your understanding that he was about to resign, and indeed, later that day, he did tender his
resignation. Well, he said he was resigning. He hasn't officially, I checked just moments before this program started, he hasn't officially sent the letter. I'm now told the letter will go in on Monday.
Yes.
Which also happens.
And his
to
resignation,
be the day
I thought he said, would take effect August 15th.
It will take effect August 15th. I don't, you know, I wish he were still here. I think he's traveling this week. You know, he's said he would resign, and then he started publicly complaining about who might replace him.
There seems to be a brewing brouhaha over who should replace
him.
No,
there's not going to be a brouhaha. It's going to be Ron. He's going to be White, the guy who beat him in the election. That's who the party's going to appoint him to fill out the term, and then he'll officially take over on January 2nd.
But I'm shouldn't thinking, he actually have to win the term first before
well,
he's
no,
placed
does,
in that
have
position?
To obey the laws. The law is that the D.C. Democratic State Committee gets to pick the interim person, and it, Anita Bonds, is the chair of that.
Last time they picked the head of the Democratic State Committee.
Robert White will be the person, and then he'll take it officially. But here's the deal. What I don't understand is Vince Orange is going to be the CEO, president, chief lobbyist for the D.C. Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
Why would you, if you're going to be the chief lobbyist and the commerce, the chamber has a lot of business before the council, why would you pick a fight over Robert White? If there's some 6-6 vote on the council and Robert White's a deciding vote, and you have to go lobby him, what are you going to do? I said, I'm sorry, I tried to keep you off the council. It's just ridiculous. I don't
How
know
about
what Vincent
I'm
Orange
still
is
smarting over my no, defeat he, by what? Robert White. He's not exactly my favorite person right now.
Yeah, but so what? You know, he won. You know, our guest here in the studio, if he could talk politics now, could, you know, you try to neutralize your enemies. You don't try to inflame them.
Well, we'll have to see what happens with that. But you're fairly sure at this point that the State Committee is going to appoint Robert White to fill
well,
that
I don't
seat.
Know. I mean, I can't.
Even
you know,
as he's running all, for it.
That is the intention. That is the expectation. And I'll be surprised if anything other than that happens.
We'll talk about a situation in Virginia very shortly in which someone is likely to be replacing Senator Tim Kaine. We'll see what Brian Moran has to say about that. But before we get there, another scathing report by the Federal Transit Administration on metro safety. The FTA report blasting metro's safety systems and saying essentially that even SafeTrack is compromising metro's safety. It just seems to me that, and it said that metro safety was being compromised by SafeTrack in the interest of service and convenience.
Well, we can, you know, just one more report, add it to the shelf. No, Metro was not properly run for nearly 40 years. It was a shiny new thing back in the 70s, and now, 40 years later, everyone who's had anything to do with Metro shares in the blame that it has run down so badly. And you can't fix something without a lot of disruption. And, you know, they've closed the weekend. There are a lot of low-income workers or people who work in bars and restaurants and different
things. That may be true. But when Metro's GM Paul Wiedefeld said At least can we have a conversation about that? And then the FDA says you're compromising safety for service if we keep insisting that you've got to maintain the level of service, and the FDA says it's compromising safety. What do we do? Can we really have both?
Well, if we can have 100% safety by closing the system.
Exactly.
Everybody give everyone a bicycle. No, it's okay. It's whether it's the Secretary of Transportation, the federal secretary, or whether it's the FDA trying to do its job, it is important that safety be an issue. It's not safety at all costs. Is you're supposed to move people safely through the system. It's not just safety. Again, you could close and you'd be 100% safe.
That's true, but Paul Wiedefeld seems to be suggesting that because this is an old system and it's doing a lot more than it was first designed to do, that we can continue to offer the level of service that we're offering and maintain a good safety record. Can we have that conversation?
Well, he can do all that. Yeah, you can limit the number of trains. There are people like me who have virtually stopped using Metro because it's inconvenient, it's unreliable, and I don't have to use it. But there are hundreds of thousands of people in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. who need Metro to work, and it needs to function for all the people who work in the region.
Well, Brian Moran, help me out. You're a public safety guy. Do we need to compromise service in order to make sure that Metro is safe?
I'm having to deal with easy issues in Virginia, like heroin and opioid crisis,
hurricane
preparedness, community-based policing efforts, corrections. Nice to be back in Northern Virginia, though, where D.C. politics and Metro dominate the conversation.
Dominating the rest of this conversation.
But you understand, Metro is, Mr. Wiedefeld is trying to, came from the Baltimore airport. He's trying to fix the system. He's trying to slow it down to make room to fix it while it operates. And there are a lot of issues. I mean, and one big issue, I think you might agree, I don't know what you are constrained to say or do politically with your big job you have in Virginia now. But, the federal government is complaining a lot, but it's offering no operational monies at all. And so that doesn't help.
Well, they do complain a lot. Congress does as well. And I will tell you, when it comes to heroin, they just passed legislation that didn't have the funding that provides for treatment for those who have the addiction of heroin and opiates. So I am familiar with that, and I can't speak to that we do not necessarily.
Well, that's a pattern in Zika.
They pass laws, they tell us to do things, but then don't provide the funding. Though in some areas, they really do provide the funding. Homeland Security, they've provided grants, and some other areas that provide grants.
Our guest is Brian Moran. He's the Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security for the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can watch the live video stream of the broadcast at our website, kojoshow.org, or shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. You are the former chair of Virginia's Democratic Party. First, what do you think of Hillary Clinton's pick of Tim Kaine as her running mate, and what will it mean for the battleground state of Virginia in November?
We're thrilled in Virginia that she chose Tim Kaine. I lean toward governors. I like folks who have executive experience, for one, just as a regular old voter. But those of us who have had the opportunity to work with Tim Kaine closely, I was in the legislature when he was both lieutenant governor, and even before that, when he was mayor of Richmond, and lieutenant governor worked closely, and then certainly as governor. So he knows how to balance budgets and brings that executive decision-making ability with him. And bottom line, too, is he's just a really great guy. I mean, he really is. He's someone that has a lot of integrity. He's honest, someone you enjoy spending time with. I think that people will see that over the course of those who do not know him throughout the country will see that over the next coming months.
He is a likable person compared to the presidential nominees, Hillary Clinton.
I'm not going there.
Well, I know you led me to this water. I'm going to drink it. The fact is, there's the negatives for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. They're not equal. There's very serious differences there. But, he is kind of an all-around, everyday guy. I mean, anyone who has ever dealt with him, who has fought with him, who has agreed with him, if he gets out enough, he was in New Orleans, I think, this week, speaking to an African-American convention, a church convention, National Baptist Convention, and he's citing biblical passages, and it's not put on. He actually knows this. He's just not making it up, reading from a teleprompter.
Yeah, his bilingual ability to speak Spanish is an asset as well. And he really is. He's a very thoughtful individual. He doesn't come off as that, you know, he doesn't have that political response to the questions that I think have really turned people off. Yeah, he's very genuine.
Here's the election.
That will really resonate with voters throughout Virginia.
The Clinton administration has withdrawn its plans to spend money in the state of Virginia, which is bad news for mine and other TV stations because we don't get the ads. But it sounds like, is she too confident that Virginia will be Democratic?
I have no idea the decisions. I really don't engage in politics anymore. I love being Secretary of Public Safety because it's an issue that's bipartisan and we can work across party lines, and it just doesn't lend itself to partisan discussions. Even gun violence, we were able to address guns this past session in a bipartisan way, which is typically a very polarizing issue. I have no idea what the Clinton campaign is planning to do. I really don't.
You ran for governor in 2009. You know the state.
I was Democratic caucus chairman for 8 years, traveling around Virginia. So I know the state very well.
Are you constrained because of a legal position that you hold, or because you think it's the appropriate position?
I think it's the appropriate position. Governor McAuliffe is doing a fabulous job as governor. I think he's done a tremendous job, and I think the fact that we enjoy a very low unemployment rate, one of the lowest in the southeastern states of America, will benefit the Democratic candidate for President Hillary Clinton.
You're going to ask one more political question?
Well, yes, I am, because you suggested it.
If Senator Kaine becomes Vice President of the United States, who should replace him in the Senate?
I will.
Doug Wilder has an opinion. But, of course, Doug always has opinions.
I will mimic my boss, Governor McAuliffe, and say, let's win in November 1st before those conversations are engaged in.
But you would say that it would be a Democrat, and I'm sure you would say there are several Democrats who could fit the bill. I could be your press person. I can answer all your questions.
He's trying
to get to serious subjects.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration yesterday said it will not call for reclassifying marijuana. It's currently a Schedule I drug, the most restrictive federal category, of course, despite disappointing the decriminalization movement. Does that change anything from your perspective around public safety in Virginia?
We were just in on the eastern shore of Virginia with Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam and Bill Hazel, Secretary of Health. Early on in the governor's administration, he assigned myself and Secretary Hazel to work on the heroin and opiate abuse epidemic in Virginia. And because it really is a healthcare crisis as well as a law enforcement crisis. And I will tell you, as we travel around Virginia, whether it's Winchester or Wise County in southwest Virginia or on the eastern shore, they will tell you a lot of these heroin addicts start early. They start using marijuana as teenagers, and it escalates into more dangerous drugs. That is my perspective, because that is what I have heard from addicts, former addicts. I've heard that from law enforcement. And so we're going to continue to enforce the laws of the Commonwealth as they are currently written and do everything we can to address the addiction of those who are subject to heroin and opiates. And it's a big issue all over the country. But we're now looking at probably over 1,000 deaths, which exceeds automobile crash deaths in Virginia. And so despite all of our efforts over the last, you know, over almost 2-3 years now to pass laws to address this, it continues to increase.
You mentioned you're looking at 1,000 deaths, but say a little bit more about what the scope of the issue of heroin and opioid addiction is in Virginia.
Yeah, the scope is broad in that there's a variety of issues to discuss. You could talk about the use of opiates. You know, we're 5%.
Where is it? In Maryland, Montgomery County, suburban areas. Is it all over? It rural areas?
Drawn a lot of attention because it's suburban. You know, we all old enough to remember the crack war, you know, crack cocaine in the 80s, and it was primarily inner city. And now, you know, heroin, you're seeing it in the suburbs, exurbs, rural, urban. And so that has drawn the attention of a lot of individuals and you know, policy leaders around this, appropriately so. We're drawing attention to it. You know, we're 5% of the population, the world's population, right? You hear that mass incarceration term. We incarcerate too many people despite only being 5% of the population. We use over 90% of the world's supply of opiates. So, you know, we had an opiate crisis, pain-killing management occurring for a couple of decades here in dispensing opiates. We have, I think the medical community has been engaged. I think we're trying to do a good job there. More needs to be done. But in the last few years, we really have used what's called a prescription monitoring program so we can monitor prescriptions. So we can avoid, you know, doctor shopping, over-prescription. And so what we've seen, though, as we start to crack down on over-prescription of opiates, people going to heroin. They're addicted to the opiates. Now they can't find them. They go to the heroin. Heroin is far too accessible. It's cheap. And our law enforcement agencies are hard at work trying to eradicate it and eliminate the source. But, you know, whenever if you have demand, you'll have supply. And so this is a twofold. We're going to use law enforcement to crack down, but you've got to address the demand. And that is around addiction. You need treatment. You need prevention efforts.
Advocates for the decriminalization of marijuana would dispute the idea that it's a gateway drug to heroin or cocaine or any of those addictive drugs. Then that's why they wanted it off the Schedule One as one with no medical benefit. 26 states have medical marijuana legalized. A half dozen states in the District of Columbia have legalized the casual use of recreational use of marijuana. It has demonstrated medical capabilities. Is there any evidence that it is in fact a gateway drug?
There's a lot.
No,
there's evidence on both sides. I mean that is a
prescription
polarizing
drugs.
Issue.
Clearly,
a lot of,
prescription drugs are clearly a gateway to illegal drugs.
And when you see films about heroin and people are using marijuana, really, it could be because they just have an addictive personality. Whether it's marijuana or opiates, they could be doing anything. But I'm not here to debate marijuana. What I have to do as Secretary of Public Safety is look at the current laws of the Commonwealth, make sure that they're being enforced fairly, and make sure that we can address what is today an enormous crisis.
Well, one approach
opiate.
That some jurisdictions have taken is a drug court for first-time offenders. What is Virginia doing?
Drug court. We should expand drug courts. The governor is a big proponent. I'm a big proponent. We only have 23 in Virginia. Yet West Virginia has a drug court in every jurisdiction. Challenge around drug courts, you start to get into some of the ideological debates. You know, is it soft on crime? These are folks who are abusing drugs. They're breaking the law. You should address it as a punitive measure as opposed to treatment. Drug courts suggest, hey, let's try to treat it as an addiction, as a disease. Let's provide services and treatment.
We should have started that in the 1960s.
Well, hey, I'd like to start more of it now. I'd like to expand drug courts in Virginia. In Virginia, the law even says the prosecutor has to agree. So there's checks and balances. You need more services available, though, so that the judge has alternatives to incarceration. Rather than locking them up in state prison, it costs us $28,000 a year. We're having to refurbish a brand new prison for women because so many women are breaking the law, and primarily it's around substance abuse. They have to steal to support their habit, whether it's an opiate habit or a heroin addiction. So it's costly. And so putting money into services early on, I think, is fiscally prudent, saves taxpayers a lot of money in the long run, in addition to being the more humane approach to making sure these people can, you know, get back on their feet.
You've got something like 33,000 people in state prisons, mm-hmm. another 58,000 people are in some kind of community program.
Here's Carla in Vienna who wants to talk about prisons. Carla, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Brian. Carla from Virginia Cure.
Carla Peterson, nice to hear from you. How are you today?
I had a couple of questions. First of all, I'm hiding here in my home, which is nicely air-conditioned, and thinking about prisoners who are in un-air-conditioned prisons. And I was told, I guess last year or so, that any prison built after 95 is air conditioned, but many that were built before that are not. And I know that Greenville was being retrofitted for air conditioning. Is there any news about prisons? And I'm especially concerned, by the way, because of global warming, and we're getting more and more hot days, and we have a lot of people in prison in poor health.
All right, Carla. So thank you, and Carla should be recognized for her efforts as well as her organization's efforts to giving voice to those who don't really have a voice in our system. And we try to work with Carla and Virginia Cure in addressing the issues. Most of the time we agree. Air conditioning, I mean, I have not been made aware that any of our facilities currently are not air conditioned. I have not heard that as a complaint. I can certainly look into that. Happy to look into that. But I've not heard.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of our jails and prisons. But we went into a prison. You know, we're substandard. But we went into a prison building mode in the 90s, and we have. What we're trying to do now is particularly with our juveniles, this last year we were able to reach a bipartisan agreement to close two prisons for juveniles. You could not distinguish between that juvenile prison and an adult prison with the barbed wire and the concrete walls, a lack of access to educational or rehabilitation programs. And for juveniles, you have to realize they're getting out. They're going to get out at 21 or a little older. And we had a system where they stayed for up to 18 months in our juvenile prisons. They would get out, and 8 out of 10, 80% of them would commit another crime within 3 years. So you're just further victimizing the community, and you're not getting those kids back on their feet. We're totally transforming with the governor's leadership and Republican support in the legislature.
Are any of the prisons run by the private?
We have one private prison. I get asked that a lot about private, you know, outsourcing.
Because it's a very bad record for many people,
right,
saying the private industry is not doing a good job.
Folks have expressed a lot of interest about that. We have one in Lawrenceville, and I will tell you, I've met with them several times to ask those sorts of questions, and I've not received complaints particular to Lawrenceville. And what's important, Tom, in the system is that a judge would not know where a prisoner is going. I mean, there's level from what levels 1 to 5 in terms of security in a facility, and they wouldn't know a particular prison where they were going. And that was the case out of Pennsylvania. That was so egregious. The judge was invested, and he knew, you know, he was sending kids, inmates, to a particular prison. That would not occur in Virginia. And again, I have not received complaints about that facility, so that has not just been not particularly raised an issue in Virginia. While we're talking about prisons, though, let me tell some good news to you, the listeners here.
This is the media. We don't need the good news.
Well, you got a lot of listeners, though. Everyone is listening this afternoon, frankly, in an air-conditioned automobile or home, I hope. We have the second lowest recidivism rate in the country.
I saw that. I was looking at that.
Yeah, second lowest.
22% or something?
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit, about
23.
And we want to be number one by the time Governor McAuliffe leaves office. But that's because we've invested in rehabilitation programs. 2 years ago, the governor had to make some substantial cuts to the budget. And instead of eliminating the reentry programs, we closed three facilities. That was tough. As it turns out, no employees, no correctional officers lost their jobs. But at the beginning, when that decision was made, that was a consequence. But, you know, we decided, you know, reentry is that important because it's not only for the inmate, but this is about making sure our streets are safe. If they get out of prison without any education or skills or cognitive behavior changes, if they just come out another criminal, they're going to commit another offense. They're going to victimize somebody, and that just doesn't make any sense. And you lock them up again. So,
revolving door.
Yeah. So the governor did. You know, there was tough budget battles, and we did that, and it was the right thing to do. But consequently, we're the second lowest, and we want to get to number one because it makes our streets safer in the long run.
You have a big, much bigger portfolio than just the prisons and public safety. You have Homeland Security.
Do.
What does that mean? You have
juvenile justice, emergency management.
Lots of things.
Yeah.
But in terms of Homeland Security, again, this is the politics hour.
State police, the National Guard.
You know, whether he was joking or whether he was commenting or whether he's misunderstood.
Now, you want to get back into politics?
Yes,
okay?
I do. I'm sorry. You ran for governor. You're guilty. But, you know, you do have a public safety issue where you have to work with the federal government. You've got the Pentagon. You've got major military installations. You've got federal workers.
All of the above, yes.
When after the Pentagon 911, there was concern that Arlington and the District of Columbia, there was no, I don't use that word, interoperability. I think that word should be stricken from the vocabulary. But there was
Can you take all the acronyms with it?
Yes, all
of them. Oh, God, I've never heard so many acronyms in all my
life
dealing with these groups.
Are the public safety agencies of Virginia able to talk to each other and to the neighboring jurisdictions so that we can, when something happens, we won't have congressional hearings saying, why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that?
Mm. How much time do you have?
You have 2 minutes.
I have some good news and some bad news. Since 9/11, there has been a tremendous amount of coordination between the federal government, local government, all the various entities, with a joint commitment so that we can address these types of issues and make sure that we respond effectively. Now, has all that been accomplished? I can't say with 100% certainty you would be satisfied, or any taxpayer or any citizen in this country would be satisfied with where we are in terms of
interoperability. Certainly militarize the police forces, which is a whole different issue. What's the bad news?
Well, we just haven't... there's a lot of technology in terms of our communication systems and the radios and the different frequencies. But I will tell you, all of the stakeholders are trying to do their best to make sure that in the case of an emergency, the citizens will be protected. And we've
next
had examples of that. We've had snowstorms in Virginia. We've
next
had
month
tornadoes.
Is the 15th anniversary of 9/11.
And a lot of money has been spent. I'm anxious to read. There was a recent article in The Atlantic about somebody has actually studied where all the Homeland Security grants. And I'll tell you something, Homeland Security grants, we get about $7 million a year. And when the McAuliffe administration came in, this money was being distributed, and you're kind of wondering on what basis, what decision-making basis. We brought in stakeholders, over 100 stakeholders from around Virginia now, and they actually provide a point system to the applications. Of course, you get applications of over about $40 million worth, and you only have $7 million to hand out. But we prioritize in terms of how many people are benefited by that grant. And what's the likelihood of that type of emergency occurring in Virginia? And so we distribute funds on those basis, and we bring in all the stakeholders. It's not me. It's not the governor distributing this money. It's the stakeholders. That's the way I think every state should do it. We've done it that way. I think it's an innovative approach, and it's the appropriate approach.
Got to get Jason's call, and Jason in Washington has been waiting for a while. Jason, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Secretary, for your work in Virginia. We all appreciate your work on public safety. I had a question about the Commission on Parole Review that reported out last year. They reported out something like 20 recommendations that would have changed sentencing structures and changed sentences in Virginia. Has there been any effort whatsoever to implement any of these changes?
There was an effort. Some good news and some bad news. If you're supportive of those recommendations, depending on your perspective, we did. We assembled a very diverse group to review parole, because the governor thought, it's been 20 years since Governor George Allen and the legislature eliminated all parole in Virginia. You're sentenced to a crime in Virginia, there is no parole. It's none of this, you're going to do 50% of it or 25% of it. So we thought it was time. Are we getting our money's worth? Is it working? Are our streets safer? And we did come out with a number of recommendations. Recommendations that went to the legislature were defeated almost in their entirety. I'll try to think of a couple of that might have passed. But we tried to work with the legislature, and, it becomes ideological. It comes, this is soft on crime. Nobody wants to be reducing sentences on crimes.
We have about a minute left.
But the good news is we made historic investments in reentry programs with Republican support, bipartisan support, historic investments in reentry. So through the budget, we were able to accomplish a great deal. Legislatively, not so much. But so I'd say it was probably a we won some, we lost some out of that Parole Review Commission. But it was the appropriate thing to do. It had been 20 years since parole was abolished. Let's take a look at it.
Jason, thank you very much for your call. Brian Moran is Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
There's so much more to talk. We didn't even talk about guns.
Oh, we didn't have enough
reducing
time
reducing gun violence. And you're wearing orange, which is the color that they have adopted to
We'll bring some Second Amendment people in to talk about guns.
We've got to find common...
I'm trying to get you back to politics. Speaking of politics, have you forsworn running for public office again? I realize not now are you doing this state job.
I am loving my current job.
Any future back to politics?
Being the Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security has been an honor of a lifetime. Yeah, I'll be forever grateful to Governor McAuliffe.
Coming up next is Betty Weller, President of the Maryland State Education Association. If you have questions or comments for her, call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojawamu.org, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or watch the live video stream of this broadcast at our website, kojoshow.org. Tom Sherwood, the Department of Justice, just released a report on Baltimore policing in which there are some surprises given the fact that a lot of the members of the African-American community in Baltimore always knew this. A lot of people outside did not do this. One incident that was reported is that the department was on a ride-along when a supervisor told a patrol officer to stop and question a group of young black men for no valid reason. Make something up, the sergeant said. Lock up all the black hoodies, a commander once ordered. Another officer wrote on Facebook, do not treat criminals like citizens. This all from a report on NPR. But the Justice Department says that the Baltimore Police Department is guilty, has been committing a variety of civil rights violations over the years.
This is a horrific finding. It's not a surprise, unfortunately, to many African Americans who have said this and many others, whether... The Baltimore Police Department apparently has just been unhinged. I will just cite the Baltimore Sun, who called the behavior, the policies, both real and just done out on the street, blatant and brazen, and said despite the mayor and the police chief currently and the chief before him, that while they said they were going to do different things, this is going to require a wholesale change in the Baltimore Police Department. You just read this. They have any incidents there. There's one African-American who was stopped 50 times in a short period of time, no charges. It was just harassment of people on the street. It's at core racist, at core not productive in terms of getting the community to work with police for real crimes. It just sounds like they have been down a very dark hole, and somebody's got to pull the city of Baltimore out of it.
Joining us in studio is Betty Weller, president of the Maryland State Education Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Maryland State Education Association, representing Maryland teachers and Republican Governor Larry Hogan, seem to be butting heads publicly these days over state education funding. Last week, Governor Hogan called teachers union members who oppose his recent budget decision thugs. What's your response to that characterization, and what are the issues that could be causing this kind of conflict?
I think it's very disappointing and very unfortunate. I'm a middle school teacher. I taught seventh grade for over 30 years, and I'm also a grandmother. And
been called a thug before in your life?
Well, generally.
Thug in chief, no.
Back in 2004, Secretary Page called the National Education Association a terrorist organization. It's not exactly thugs, but it's along the same lines.
Same family.
So, you know, it's disturbing to me because we don't expect our professionals and elected politicians to be talking that way. They set examples for our students. And I wonder if students are beginning to think, because of all the name calling in the recent political discourse, that it's OK to do that. We try to teach them that it's not OK to do that.
Do you the governor? Some people said the governor, when he said thugs, that he was, and has been written by several people, that he was talking about teachers. And of course, the governor says he's not talking about the teachers. He has a great deal of respect for teachers. He did not have respect for the leadership of your union that was pushing these issues. And those were the thugs he was talking about, not teachers. Do you agree with that characterization?
Well, when you say union thugs, our members are the union. We are the union. Educators are the union. And I am the leadership. And the comments where...
Have you called him?
No, I have not.
Why don't you just pick up... Would you have his number? We'll call him. Why don't you just call up the governor and say you'd like to meet with him and see what this is all about?
Well, quite frankly, I sent the governor a letter 2 days after he was elected and said, you know, I would love to meet with you. Congratulations. I'm sure there are issues of commonality we can discuss regarding education. I never received a response. Repeated requests were made to meet with him over the years, and we've never even gotten a sorry, not going to do that.
Not even a response?
Not even a response.
What are the issues in this particular case? And it seems to be the budget that Governor Hogan recently approved and state funding for schools. What is the Teachers Association's standpoint on those issues?
Well, we believe that we're looking for high-quality schools for our students. And high-quality schools, if we're going to be successful, the strategies and the programs that make us successful require additional resources. We have more children coming out of poverty than we've ever had. We have more children with special ed needs than we've ever had. We have more English language learners than we've ever had. And in order to meet these students' needs and to provide them the education we're obligated to provide them, we need resources. So, you know, education is expensive and the costs for educating children are not going down. We were delighted last year when the legislature passed a bipartisan budget that included the $25 million that the governor has now decided not to give to public schools this year. And that's on top of the $68 million he didn't give the schools last year that was earmarked for public education.
The governor will say he's increased spending 2 years in a row for education, and that the way the legislature has set up these funds to be dispensed is that he has to spend all the money exactly the way the legislature says it or not spend any of it. And so he decided not to spend any of it because he was not given any executive authority to make any decisions.
Well, I think the fact that he's spent more money is a result, direct result of the increase in funding formulas, because when you look at what was spent, it was absolutely nothing more than was required to be spent. And in terms of, the all or nothing piece, to me, that speaks to the priorities of the governor. Public school students are in need of resources, and in fact, our teachers are as well. He withheld money last year and said he wanted to put it in the pension fund, which I don't think legally he could do. This year, he's withholding money that was supposed to be put in the pension
fund. The legislature set aside money to help local governments fund teacher pensions, but Governor Hogan says he has chosen not to spend that money because he'd rather keep it in a rainy day fund, having already increased funding for schools and having shored up pensions. Why not put some money away for unforeseen needs and emergencies?
Well, my understanding is there was a $360 million surplus in the budget. So if that's the case, and this money is earmarked for students who really need it, I'm not sure that we need to keep it in the rainy day fund at this point.
They're saying that the expected revenues going forward are not going to be as nearly as high as they have been, and that you have to prepare for the future.
We all prepare for the future, but when you have needs and priorities, you find a way to make it happen. And I think our students are priority. Over 85% of our students in Maryland are public school students. Many of our buildings are aging, and many, you know, in the next few years, we're going to lose 2 million teachers in this country because of retirement and things like that. And the number of folks going into education right now is plummeting. Recently, the Education Policy Institute came out with a report that said teachers in Maryland make only 83% of what college graduates in Maryland make. And I don't understand that because teachers are college graduates.
So if you're a teacher in Maryland, give us a call. Where do you come down on this issue? 800-433-8850. You can send email to Kojo at WAMU.org. Our guest is Betty Weller, president of the Maryland State Education Association. It's my understanding that a committee has been formed to help hash out these hot-button issues of school funding, and a joint appointment of the chair just happened last week. Tell us about this commission, its chair, and what it is tasked with doing.
It's the new version, I guess, of the old Thornton Commission.
That's what I was thinking, and I remember what happened to the recommendations of that commission. If we can find out where they're buried, but go ahead.
Well, we're delighted that this commission is being appointed, and we think Commissioner Kerwin is going to be a great chair for the committee. When the Thornton Commission made its recommendations almost 15 years ago now, it was great for public education, and our legislature did what it was constitutionally obligated to do, and that was found the money to provide this efficient, effective public education for students. But those formulas are now outdated. There's been such a shift in the demographics of our students. There have been shifts in where they are, in the kind of students they are, and so we need to update. And we're looking forward to talking about, you know, what the funding formula should be for public schools moving forward.
You should know that Alvin Thornton, who chaired that commission, just recently ran for Congress in Maryland, but was defeated in the primary in Prince George's County. Just a little tidbit of information.
Yes, a little ancient history.
He's a wonderful man.
Well, let's look forward in the Politics Hour. Your Fund for Children and Education, which is the political action committee of your education association, is considered one of the most powerful in the state. You supported Anthony Brown in October of 2014, a month before the election. You formally endorsed him at your convention. The 2018 election already is gearing up. If I were Governor Hogan, a Republican who has stayed away from Donald Trump, who didn't go to the Cleveland convention, who's trying to focus on the state so he can run for do the right thing and run for re-election, does he have any hope of getting an endorsement from the teachers union? If not, why should he pay much mind to you?
Well, you know, we actually have a very strict process for people getting endorsements. Whenever there is an election, regardless of whether it's local, state, national, we send out questionnaires to anybody who is even rumored to be a candidate. And part of our process is you must fill out and return the questionnaire if you desire to be considered for endorsement. Many times there are politicians who choose not to. When Governor Hogan was running as a candidate, we sent him a questionnaire. He did not return it. My guess is if we sent him a questionnaire next time, he probably wouldn't return it. Therefore, we can't even consider endorsement for him.
Oh, that's good. I looked at your 2014 endorsements and the whole list. It looks like 100 or more plus Democrats or only 3 Republicans. Is that, again, an example of people not, of Republicans not returning the questionnaire?
Yes, sir, it is. In my opinion, public education should be a nonpartisan issue, and we are looking for people who are running for office who are supportive of our students and our educators and public education in general. And it doesn't matter to me what their political party is. But if they choose not to take part in our process, there isn't much we can do about it.
You're part of the National Education Association.
Yes, sir.
Is that right? They have a big sign on there, I think, on their 16th Street headquarters downtown supporting Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
We got to.
Does that make it harder for Republicans to deal with you, because they think that you're predisposed to not like anything they might say?
I'm sure it does. But we have had Republicans who have gone through our process, and actually some of them have come very close to getting endorsements. And in our local races, there are a number of them who have been endorsed.
Very good.
Moving on to other issues, over-testing is something that teachers and a lot of parents and students are concerned about. What are the issues as the Teachers Association sees it around standardized testing?
A few years ago, it was decided that we should have test scores as part of teacher evaluations. And at that point in time, only about 29% of our teachers had standardized tests. So there was this push to make sure that every subject, not just English and math, but every subject now had some sort of a test that was standardized, at least on the local level, if not on the state or federal level, so that you could have a test as part of a teacher evaluation. And so what happened was there were more and more tests being given to more and more students all the time, in every grade, in every subject. And teachers did not go learn how to be teachers so that they could administer tests. They went to school to learn how to teach students. And in order for them to teach, they need time, and students need time to learn. So it's a great frustration to teachers that testing has become the be-all, end-all.
That's what you do. You end up teaching for the test as opposed to teaching a more broad-based curriculum.
Absolutely.
A commission recently reviewed this. What were the conclusions?
There were a number of recommendations. I actually brought some of them with me, but some of them were, one of them that we thought was very good was to establish district committees on assessment so that each district could look at the assessments that are being given. Because truthfully, every district gives essentially the same amount of standardized testing, like the PARC test. You know, that has a uniform number of hours for every grade, every test they give. But then there are districts who put in local testing to get ready for the test, to so students will learn the format of the test. And the number of hours of local mandated testing varied quite a bit from district to district. So what we think is a great recommendation from the Testing Commission is that these district committees will begin to look at the local tests and will say, okay, is there duplicativeness in them? Is this test giving us the information we need? Is this information being evaluated somewhere else? Do we need to have this test? And so we're hoping to reduce the number of tests or assessments that students have to take.
There was some disappointment that the process didn't go farther. What more do you feel should have been done?
Well, we had last year in the legislature, we supported a bill that would have capped the amount of annual standardized mandated testing at 2% of annual instructional time. And we were sort of hoping that people would use that as a guide. There was no such guide in the recommendations. But I'm hoping that that districts will understand that parents want their students to learn. They don't want them to become test takers. And so we hope that parents will help us look at the test. Parents should be part of these district assessments, assessment committees.
Let's talk about specifically Montgomery County, if we can, because for 8 years, every year for 8 years, there's been an increase in enrollment of 2,000 or so students. Mm-hmm. There has been a dramatic increase in the number of English second language students, whether Latinos or others, coming into the county. There's something like 880,000 students in the state of Maryland. It seems to me that the politics of education isn't anywhere close to addressing all of these needs. I looked up Controversy Education Maryland, and I had to stop looking. There were so many different things. Is there any hope that you think that whether it's the Republican governor or whether it's the Democratic leader, Ike Leggett of Montgomery County or anyone else, or Sharon Baker in Prince George's County, that people can get back on the same page of what education is? Or is this an endless fight like we're seeing across the nation?
I would not like to think it's an endless fight. I think, you know, one of the first things we need to do is talk to each other about this. And we need to find the common ground. We need to find the things that are working. We need to share the best practices. We need to recognize that we do have more of these students with more of these needs. I was listening to your previous guest, and one of the things that we're not talking about right now in schools that we should be talking about more is the fact that many of these children in poverty are coming to school having witnessed traumatic episodes in their neighborhoods, and they come to school and they're not ready to learn.
Glad you brought that up, because that allows me to bring in Pete in Bowie, Maryland. Pete, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, and a statement is, that Maryland certainly has excellent schools and they're generally in the wealthier, predominantly white suburbs. But the last round of NAEP scores from the federal government showed that Baltimore City schools were the second lowest performing in the country, and African-American 4th and 8th graders were about 13-14% proficient on average. These are children who are graduating, if they graduate from high school, on a 5th, 6th, 7th grade level. Yet we spend more money in Baltimore than anywhere else. My question, I guess, to your guest would be, what are we going to do to make sure that children in the city or English language learners have the same opportunity to a fantastic education that they do in the wealthier suburbs? what we're doing right now and continuing to spend more money without implementing reforms simply is not working for children who need it.
Here's Betty Weller.
Thank you for that question. My philosophy, and I think the philosophy of my association, is that every school in Maryland should look like the best school in Maryland. And so we need to determine what that looks like. And then we need to look at the schools that aren't the best schools, and we need to say, why not? What are the barriers? What are the needs? What resources need to be brought to bear on this school? It's not a cookie-cutter approach. People have to be willing to come together, parents, politicians, educators, everybody, to make this happen.
What about year-round schools? The District of Columbia, Kaya Henderson, has been moving schools, 11 more this year, into year-round schools so that the children who do have needs are in school and not wasting time on summer vacations.
You only have about 30 seconds.
Well, I think there's an opportunity to talk about community schools. If a community wants a year-round school and that community comes together and talks about how to pool resources and how to find resources to make that happen, I think that can only benefit the students in that community.
Betty Weller is president of the Maryland State Education Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Sherwood, the Office of People's Counsel in the district has formally appealed the Public Service Commission's decision approving the Pepco-Exelon merger. Sandra Matavus-Frye said they are appealing the Public Service Commission's order because of a number of procedural weaknesses, which she says need to be addressed by the D.C. Court of Appeals.
You know, it's taken a long while for them to get to this point to challenge it, but they say the consumers are not do not benefit from this merger.
Were you expecting that they would at some point
be
a court challenge?
Carl Racine, the Attorney General, has already said that he's challenging it, so... So it's going to court.
It ain't over till it's over. So this merger will not be able to go forward.
No, the merger is going forward. This is an appeal of the merger.
Yeah, but even if the merger is going forward, can the Court of Appeals stop it in its tracks?
Courts are very powerful, Kojo. Don't go before one.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure.
Have a great weekend.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more for you online. Our summer interns have wrapped up their work for us, but not before Patty Morales left us with one last story. She sat down with a local activist who is the child of undocumented immigrants. They discussed the ways so-called dreamer stories are being told in the midst of the current presidential election cycle. Be sure to check out Patty's good work at kojoshow.org/blog. And remember, if you're heading out of town, we like to travel too. Take this show with you by subscribing to the broadcast via your favorite podcast app. Whatever your weekend plans, stay cool and be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking about the long-awaited Museum of African American History and Culture, slated to open this fall. Founding director Lonnie Bunch joins us. That's coming up Monday at noon. Tom Sherwood, you've actually been into this.
No, Bunch is a great interview. That's a good thing. We've done a lot of stories at NBC4 about the museum. It's going to open up late September. The Trump Hotel is opening on the 12th if you need more
information. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.